second link, I hope, will bring the quiz up. You can bring that up, and then I'm going to break everybody into groups quickly. And then I'll give you really not very long, maybe 4 or 5 minutes at the most. And you can work on the quiz and see how well you do. All right. So there's at least 2 people in every group. A few of them have 3, but here we go.
And is
in case anyone was wondering, this meeting is being recorded.
I don't remember till Mason's class last Sunday that I don't remember that lady coming on and announcing that. Is that a new feature?
It must be.
I'm sure it's probably in response to, we didn't know we were being recorded, and
yeah. I'm sure the software grew by 10% to put that feature in there. But I don't remember getting an update. But anyway, they do that anyway. That's probably good. Okay, let's go through these quickly. From where did Paul write Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon? What do you say? Everybody go on unmute and just shout out an answer. But if you shout one out, you can't answer the next one.
In Roman prison,
that's correct. What's the theme of Colossians? Kind of the overarching foundational?
The supremacy of Christ.
Preeminence of Christ, right. It's a strange word to pronounce and even stranger to spell with the kind of, anyway. 2 types of justification that are contrasted in the book of Romans.
Law and faith.
Law and grace.
Yeah, law-keeping, perfect law-keeping, and works, or works, and faith is the other that's contrasted. Right. Which church did Paul commend for their repeated financial support? Good. It was Philippi, the church of Philippi.
Philippi.
What did Paul ask the Colossians to do with their letter?
Share it with Laodicea.
Good. Yeah, that's right. What command did Paul give to husbands and wives regarding their spouses?
Wives submit and husbands love them like Christ.
That's correct. In both Colossians and Ephesians. Colossians is a little bit different in that it says that do not be bitter toward them, whereas Ephesians goes into a lot of detail about the comparison to Christ and the church. Good, thank you. List the book and chapter where the, what's the, this one, this is, I think, the ESV. I should have fixed this. But anyway, the light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison.
2 Corinthians.
That's right. Which chapter?
4.
Yes, 4 is good. Oops, already did it accidentally. The whole armor of God is in Ephesians 6. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth.
We don't see your screen. You're not sharing. If you meant for us to see your screen. Oh,
thank you. You should have told me before.
Sorry.
Well, you said whoops. We didn't know until you said whoops.
Okay. Oh, so you didn't actually know that answer. But anyway, the whole
time. You knew it. You had just.
All the kids knew it. Believe me, all the kids knew it. And all the teachers that teach the kids knew it.
So just out of curiosity, because I'm going to be starting this class next Sunday. When you download this file in PDF, do you still have it up right now? Are you looking at it as well? Or are you just looking at my shared screen?
Just looking at yours.
Okay.
We can't see ours because of the Zoom.
Oh, you can't open it in a separate window or put it down.
I don't know how to do it.
If you exit full screen and stuff, but it doesn't automatically show up where you can manipulate it. You have to.
Not real user friendly.
No, it's not user friendly, Marty. And I'm a kindergartner, so keep going.
You guys can help me with my class because I want to do a lot of these things with the class, and they're supposed to be younger people, right? It's the Modern Challenges class, and I'm hoping they're all going to be computer savvy and slick with all that stuff and all that. I know that when I taught this, not to embarrass anybody, but when I taught the 7th and 8th graders, they not only could download it, share the screen, and they were writing on the screen the answers to the quiz. You know what I mean? Not to embarrass you or anything, but going into groups and getting files and stuff was just like they were faster than I was even.
Okay, I need to get me one to move in the house with me, then, Donna.
Yeah, if we just had a 7th grader, we'd be in business, right?
Yeah.
set your mind on things that are above, not on things on the earth.
Colossians 3.
That's right. It's where he begins then to turn the corner from the discussion of the false teachings and so on in chapter 2 to the implications for our lives, similar to what happens in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God.
Romans 3.
Thank you. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility let each of the count the other better than himself, or ESV more significant.
It's Philippians, I know, but
that's correct.
Is it chapter 3 or 2?
Well, it's 2 at the beginning. Okay. This one, probably a couple answers would be, anyway, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up or edify.
1 Corinthians 14.
1 Corinthians.
It is 1 Corinthians. It's not 14, though.
6 and 10.
It's 10, actually. In chapter 6, he says, I'll not be brought under the power of any. That's a different
master.
Very similar thought, but interesting in two different contexts he says that. So anyway, thank you for participating in that. Tonight, we're going to talk about Paul's letters to 1 Timothy, sorry, to Timothy and to Titus, 2 to Timothy, 1 to Titus. It's sometimes grouped in the way the New Testament books were ordered by somebody in the past. They were grouped with Philemon because they appear to be personal letters. But in many ways, the letter, especially 1 Timothy, seems like it applies to a church, really almost as much as any of the other letters to churches. But in any case, they're all from Paul. They're all to a specific individual addressed that way. So here's where we got to in the timeline of Acts of the Apostles. And last time I talked about the fact that Paul was in prison, and we wonder what all had he accomplished in his time, about a decade's worth of work, until he was taken out of circulation, so to speak, and put in the prison in Caesarea for 2 years and then in Rome for maybe a couple of years. And we talked about all the things that he had done in terms of spreading the gospel to the Gentiles and collecting and writing a bunch of authoritative letters. And so on. I'm going to talk tonight at the end about something else I think as significant as all of that, that Paul had accomplished during that time and during the time we'll talk about here. But anyway, we ended with Paul in prison. That's the Acts story. And I'll draw a dotted line here to show you that the Acts of the Apostles that Luke wrote down for us to have seems to have been written about this time and ended in the history with Paul still in his own hired house, with the ability to come and go, according to Philippians, some optimism that his trial would go well. The persecution related to Nero and the burning of Rome and all that had not occurred yet. And so it was likely that he would, even Nero would not. The charges were so silly, probably from the Roman standpoint, so that he felt like, it looked like he was optimistic about his release. And so the presumption is that around 62 AD or sometime like that, he was released. After that, we don't know, except for just a few hints here and there in these letters we'll read from 1 Timothy and from Titus. It appears that he got to Crete again. I think he touched Crete on his journey to Rome. I believe that's right, on the voyage to Rome. But it's clear he didn't teach or start a church there during that brief stop. Because I think he was anxious to get away from there, as it turns out. But he does seem to have traveled. Timothy says, or the letter to 1 Timothy says, Paul says, I left you in Ephesus, right? So he must have gone back to Ephesus and then himself traveled somewhere else, similar language to Titus on Crete. So there was a period of time in which, some things happened. But eventually, we've covered the so-called traveling epistles. I found where I read that. That's from Tenney's New Testament survey. I don't think I've seen that term anywhere else. But the traveling epistles are the ones written on the second and third journeys, I guess including Galatians. And then the prison epistles we talked about last time, those four. Anyway, it looks as if Paul then was arrested again. And this time it was more serious, perhaps related to the persecution of Christians now, not just some general Jewish thing. Christianity maybe was becoming a little bit more publicly known, and and maybe opposed even more strongly by the Jews, separated, so it wasn't just a Jewish cult anymore. It had more of an identity of its own. And so anyway, for whatever reason, he was imprisoned again, and it looks like he died pretty quickly after that, maybe a year, year and a half later. Second Timothy implies there was a first hearing. No one stood with him, he says, but after that, he says the time of my departure is at hand, and so he died probably around 68 A.D. Now, during this release, he wrote 1 Timothy to Timothy at Ephesus, and he also wrote Titus probably shortly after that, or a little bit after that, to Titus, who was in Crete. And then after his arrest and the imprisonment, the last thing we hear from Paul, and we're going to say goodbye to Paul in this tonight. We're just going to say goodbye to him. We'll go back and study some earlier letters, but still, with regard to Paul's work, we're going to kind of draw that part of the New Testament history to a close. So 2 Timothy was written, and those are the three we're going to study. And they have a name which I don't like, but they're called the pastoral epistles. Anybody know why they're called the pastoral epistles?
The qualifications for elders?
That's a good guess. That'd be a good reason, but that's not the reason. Yeah, Sewell, you know, probably. Oh, except he's on mute. Stop. You need to unmute, Sewell. I'm interested in your thoughts on this in particular. I don't think I can unmute him. I can only ask to unmute. They're on mute. Okay. Well, maybe we'll hear later, but the name apparently doesn't go back very far, maybe the 1800s, but it's because Timothy and Titus were pastors of the churches, right? Does everybody agree with that?
No.
What's funny is some of these books you read, they'll say, well, we're called that, although really Timothy wasn't a pastor. If you go back to Acts chapter 20, when Paul talked to those elders at Miletus, it's clear that that's a different group, and Timothy didn't meet the qualifications, but they still call him that because that's the way we use, I don't, but the way the denominational world uses the term today. I wish it said something like, I don't know what a better term would be, evangelist epistles or something like that. I don't know. Sewell, talk to us. What did you say a while ago? We want to hear it.
I'm back on now.
Okay.
So sometimes the idea is that Paul was kind of serving as a shepherd of these evangelists, but I don't like that either.
Both of those imply some kind of a hierarchy or worldwide organization that really is not – there's no evidence of that in the letters. And it's just an ironic to me that Paul defines what a pastor actually is in both letters, Timothy and Titus, and yet they're the name that describes them abuses that term. But I'm sorry for that. But that's what they're called. So if you read books or talk about them, you'll just have to know what that term means in the world. But anyway, I'll just remind you.
I punched the wrong button and went off completely, which is typical of my technology.
Well, we saw you talking, and I was wanting to know all of what you were saying. But the second journey, Paul got to Lystra right here. And I'm going back in time a little bit. And there was a young man there, and we're going to guess how old he might have been in a minute. But he was already well spoken of by those in Lystra and Iconium. Apparently, he had done work, maybe beginning – you know, preaching a little or something in both cities so that the Christians already were impressed with his ability. And Paul, and again, maybe a theory is that now Mark, who might have been somewhat of an understudy on the first journey, was not with him. So Timothy might be able to fulfill that role. Or maybe just Paul wanted to have some help that Timothy could provide even at the young age that he had. So that's the beginning. We know that his mother and grandmother were Jewish and Christians, and his dad was a Greek, but maybe they were converted on the first journey. If you remember the first journey, Paul was beaten and left for dead in Lystra. So, Timothy, if he didn't see that with his own eyes as a young, very young boy, he heard about it from his mother and grandmother. So he knew that was the kind of trip that, that was the kind of thing that would happen to him if he went with the apostle Paul on this journey, that in a way, I got redirected. The second journey did, and we ended up with the Macedonian call, going up here to Philippi. And you remember all the things that happened there: Philippian jailer and Lydia, and then the things at Thessalonica. We got run out and Berea and all of that. So, and then Timothy went back to help the Thessalonians. Or maybe stayed, you know, I'm not going to get into that again, Brigham, but anyway, to help those guys that are in Thessalonians. So that's kind of what I was. Here's a quick biography of Timothy. We mentioned his parents, father, probably not a Christian. It's interesting to me that Paul calls him my son in the faith or my beloved son, as if he was taking the place of that, what might have been an unbelieving dad. Certainly something all young men need would be some kind of a male role model for them. He was converted in Lystra, maybe on the first journey, who knows, but he developed a good reputation, as we mentioned. He went with Paul on the second journey. He was at Troas, Philippi, Berea, and Athens. He traveled to Thessalonica and returned to Paul, who by that time was in Corinth, was part of the, you know, the testimony that Paul used to write the Thessalonian letter. And then maybe a period of 4 or 5 years, we don't really know much about where he was. But starting at the third journey, we find him at Ephesus. There he was sent to Macedonia. Implication is that during that journey, he was also sent to Corinth, which is in Achaia, by Paul. You read about that in 1 Corinthians. It's not, you know, airtight certain that he ever got there, but it seemed like at that time Paul was planning to send him to remind the Corinthians of his ways as he taught in every church, and the Corinthians were to receive him. That's chapter 16. We don't know for sure that he got there, but that was the plan. He was with Paul in Macedonia in 2 Corinthians 1:1. That's, you know, the northern part where he was riding down to Corinth the third journey. When Paul was encouraging them to get their gift ready and all of that. And then he was with Paul at Corinth when Romans was written. So he's mentioned in the Roman letter. Do you remember Paul made it to Corinth and down to Achaia, sent the letter to Rome, and Timothy was with him there. In the third journey, he traveled back to Macedonia and then to Asia, which the implication to me is that he was actually present. If you look at Acts chapter 20, about verse 4, he was present when Paul spoke to the elders at Ephesus. And why is that important? That Timothy might have heard what Paul said to those elders at Ephesus. Anybody remember what Paul said to those Ephesians? I'm sorry, maybe you're all stunned because I said at Ephesus. He wasn't at Ephesus. They were Ephesian elders. He was at Miletus. But anyway, what did he say to them?
He said that...
that even from among themselves, some would arise speaking perverse things.
Timothy heard that prophecy that Paul made about the errors that will arise at Ephesus, and it would even be from among the elders who were serving there in Ephesus. So he knew that. Then there's no record of where he was during imprisonment in Caesarea. And during the first imprisonment, he was with Paul in Rome. He's mentioned in Colossians, Philemon, and Philippians as having been with Paul in Rome. He was apparently sent to Philippi. That's mentioned in the second chapter of Philippians. Timothy was going to come to them, and there's no one like him, Paul said, who thinks about your good instead of my own, instead of his own. And finally, it looks as if he traveled with Paul to Ephesus and was left there. I should say that. And we learn that from 1 Timothy 1. Which we're looking at tonight. Does it look like Timothy was a well-traveled person? Had he spent time with Paul and knew about Paul's writings? And he knew what Paul taught in all these churches where he was and everything? I think so. And I think it's amazing that he was more or less devoting his life to this work. And going where Paul suggested that he go, doing what Paul said. It raises an interesting question, we talked about this some in the first Timothy, or the Timothy class that we did not too long ago. Do you think there's anything in the letter to Timothy, first or second, really, that Timothy didn't already know? Doctrinally, I mean. Church practice, suggestions, warnings. You think there's anything in those letters that Timothy didn't already know or heard Paul say at some point?
I think he knew it all.
I did too. I don't see how he couldn't know it. And it raises the question, in a way, why did Paul write all those things to him? Well, I think... Go ahead.
I just said to remind him, to reiterate.
For sure, that. And he does even talk about... In fact, he even says, remind the brethren of these things at one place, right? So it's almost like the brethren there at Ephesus, which is where he was, they kind of knew it too, but Timothy needed to remind them as Paul was reminding him.
And you know, second part might be his youth, because he said, don't let people look down upon your youth. You're supposed to know all these things, you know?
Yeah.
If you know all these things, don't let people look down on your youth. So it was to support him, I think.
Yeah. So that's a great thought. I'm going to build on it a little bit. A lot of what's in 1 Timothy, and especially 2 Timothy, is really not doctrine. Especially in 2 Timothy, it kind of goes beyond just here's the way the church ought to work, here's the qualifications of elders. Interspersed all the way through is this theme that you need to fulfill your ministry. You need to keep the charge I've given you. You need to be a worker that's not ashamed. You need to be a good soldier and suffer hardship. You need to be not ashamed of me, the prisoner. You understand what I'm saying? A lot of the letter, if you think about it, yes, put the brethren, you know, charge them that are rich in this present world. There's a lot of sermon titles that Paul's suggesting, but really, if you read the letters, it seems like he's saying to Timothy, you know, do your work, fulfill your ministry. These are phrases that he uses. And so there's that. So I think I built on Paul's point. I hope you're okay with that, Paul. It's not just, yeah, you're young, but, you know, you know all this stuff. It was to build his confidence. And what's another purpose maybe Paul might have had in writing letters with stuff in it that Timothy already knew, like the doctrinal things or the practical men, roles of men and women, qualifications of elders, care for widows, all that. What would be the point of Paul writing that in a letter to Timothy, whom he had left behind at Ephesus?
Maybe make it more authoritative. He would have proof.
Yeah, don't you think so? That as Timothy got this letter, and he said he was to take heed to reading and exhortation, I'm thinking that maybe some of the reading Timothy probably did out loud publicly was to read this letter to those people in Ephesus and reminding them this was from the Apostle Paul. And it gave him credibility as Paul's representative. And I believe that was a special role beyond what maybe a preacher today would have. And I'm not saying he was a bishop of the church. That's a lot of people, apparently early fathers, 100 or so years later, started to think he must have been the bishop of the church at Ephesus. No, but he was a representative of the Apostle Paul. That's a little bit beyond, this is my opinion, a little bit beyond just a regular evangelist supported by a local church. I'm interested in rebuttals or opinions about that.
Well, then my question was, the hands that were laid on him were just giving him a charge. He didn't have any spiritual gift. Is that correct?
He may have had one from Paul, but I do think the laying on of hands is actually a statement of support or an installation in a particular role or whatever. It's interesting that Timothy laid hands. I don't know if it's Timothy directly. He said, lay hands hastily on no man in that fifth chapter. Suggesting Timothy, or maybe it's this instruction through Timothy to the brethren to say, don't appoint elders too quickly till you know better about their character and the things about them. Yes, Sewell, help us here.
Paul actually mentions two laying on of hands. One occasion, laying on of the hand of the presbytery,
right,
which would be the elders of the church, and the other hand, the laying on of my hands, which I think would have given him a special gift, and he says, stir up the gift in you by laying on my hand.
Yeah, I know that there's kind of a view, I think wrong, that Timothy had some special authority over the elders or something, as in some hierarchy. But it seems to me that the elders were the ones who were giving him a particular duty, whatever that assignment was. But he did have this letter from the Apostle Paul, and the charge really to organize the church in the way that the apostle said for him to do it. Yes, Sewell?
And several times in that letter he says, this is a faithful saying, and encourages him to repeat what he has just written.
Right, and yeah. All right, so we talked a little bit about what the letter's not, or what Timothy's role was not. I'll show you quickly a timeline of Timothy's life, but really the main thing I want to point out is his possible age. Let's say that he was 15, make that up, but let's say that he was 18 when he went on the second journey with Paul. You see that, what I'm trying to do in this chart here? And I'm making that up, but I don't think he was much younger. He could have been 16 or 17. That seems pretty young, but I imagine he's about the age that most boys go off to college, perhaps. And if you use the approximate date of the timeline here, when you get to 1 Timothy, how old is Timothy himself? If you let the years keep counting up, how old is he at that time? He's just probably early 30s, perhaps. Okay, not too. And then in the second letter, which he might have been mid 30s, something like that. Trying to remember. Oh, it's Philemon, I think. Paul says, Paul the aged, right? So he describes himself as older. And so I don't know how old Paul would be, but probably maybe 60s for sure, in his 60 years old. But anyway, so Timothy would have been a younger man, clearly about the age of a son, if Paul had had a son. But that's kind of where we are. So maybe 31 and 35 would correspond to Timothy's age, which is interesting because he said, don't let anyone despise your youth. I don't know if that's a relative term compared to the false teachers or the elders around or whatever, but that's a kind of interesting thing. And that's where that one's letter was written, and then the other one written here. So remember that, those dates. Here's another timeline of interest, an age not of Timothy, but of the church at Ephesus where he was. Assuming that the church was established, somewhere, there, make it the second journey around here. By the time we get to the letter, the prison epistle to the Ephesians, it's maybe 10 years old. And then maybe when we are in the middle of those, it might be 12 or 13 years old. So that's how old the church is there. It's interesting that they had elders as far back as the third journey over here, right? So the elders had been at work for a while. But that's kind of the age of the church at Ephesus, okay? All approximate, okay? Just kind of get an order of magnitude for how old Timothy is and how long the church is. I'm not going to spend any time. I just found this chart from the Timothy class. But these are the nouns and these are the verbs down here. None of them say he was a pastor. That's kind of my point from this chart. But they do call him a minister, or it's really the same word as deacon. But, deacon is an ordinary term. I think Sewell made some mention of that with regard to Phoebe in the lesson Sunday. It's an ordinary word. It just means a servant or a minister. And that's what minister means. It's not a title. It goes on a business card. It's a role that we have of service. But we get all confused. We want to know who the minister of the church is and all that. And even the word preacher is not the word that has gospel in it, the evangelist type word that's kind of from the Greek. It's actually someone who just pronounces something. The guy that would go out yelling in the city that there's a new Caesar or something, kind of like our CNN news or something. But that's a herald. Anyway, so those are all the things Timothy is called and told to do in the two letters. Okay, y'all probably knew that Paul was the author of this. I don't spend too much time on this, but he calls Timothy my true son in the faith. He's called Timothy his son in the faith and co-worker and more than just Timothy in 1st, 2nd Timothy, but I think in Philippians for sure. I think maybe 1 Corinthians, he makes a reference to this close relationship that they had. He's young, at least young enough that someone might discount what he said because of his youth. He perhaps had stomach problems. If I had to face the kind of things that were going on at Ephesus, I might have stomach problems too. And I wonder if maybe in the context that he puts it in chapter 5 there about some men's sins are, you know, hidden at first and then they're evident, that would make my stomach start hurting. You know, point somebody and they're not really who they ought to be. And we don't know that at first. And I'm making all that up. And perhaps he wasn't confident. There's some in he mentions God didn't give us a spirit of timidity in 2 Timothy 1:6, but there's so many other passages that in a positive way seem to be bolstering Timothy's confidence, challenging him to be strong. Chapter 2 and 2 Timothy especially. Well, 2 Timothy generally, all of that. Fulfill your ministry. Things like that, stir up the gift that's in you. Those things seem like they're admonitions that might have reflected that Timothy wasn't as aggressive or confident or assertive or perhaps as he should be. I read one guy that said maybe these were all the excuses Timothy gave for not wanting to stay there at Ephesus and handle these problems. He said, I'm too young and it's too terrible here. It makes my stomach hurt and, you know, all that kind of thing. But anyway. I don't know that that's true, but those are some suggestions. And we'll contrast that to Titus. I think Titus, the hints are that Titus was a lot more confident and maybe a proactive and all that kind of thing. He did some things on his own. And I'll show you some more on the next chart about that. Time of writing, don't know, sometime in the period between the two imprisonments. And the themes are, it begins by saying, I left you there to handle these false teachers. But he goes into more details about that. And the term sound doctrine is found throughout. Sound just means healthy, whole. Almost suggesting that there is a body of doctrine, and that's what it means to be healthy. Stay with that. Don't let new stuff come in. Preach the whole thing so that it's sound, it's healthy, it's complete. That's found in both Timothy and Titus. Anyway, and then also set things in order in the church. He mentions that in chapter 3:15, and that might refer back to the roles of men and women in chapter 2, as well as the elders and deacon qualifications in chapter 3. And probably, it seems to me, looking to the care of widows and elders that, you know, there's an accusation, the elders that sin, those kind of things that are all found in chapter 5 as well. So, refute the false teaching, set things in order. And so these are some things that are in there that are important to us. Qualifications of elders and deacons, instructions for the treatment of elders, their support perhaps, old men and young men and old women and young women and widows who are not widows indeed, slaves and masters, the beginning of chapter 6, people who want to be teachers and maybe for the wrong motives in chapter 6, assuming that godliness is the way of gain. And rich people that are rich in this world, and also those who aren't rich, but they want to be, right? Meaning that they, you know, they desire to be rich, and that's maybe even use their relationship to the church or in some way their teaching ability as a way of gain there in chapter 6. And then, as we mentioned before, an endorsement of Timothy's work and teaching from Paul. Okay, let's look at your lesson sheet. Let's try to put the best titles on here. And these are pretty easy. Chapter 1, 1 through 20. We're taking a flyover of the book. What's he say in the first chapter of 1 Timothy? What would you call that?
Initial charge.
Initial charge. That's a gimme almost. But he starts off by saying, I'm urged you when I went to Macedonia to remain in Ephesus and charge some that they teach no other doctrine. So he's telling him to take that. And then he almost says in verse 18 that Timothy's adopting the charge that was committed to him. Verse 11, the gospel of the blessed God, which is committed to my trust. Verse 11, then jump to verse 18. This charge I commit to you, son Timothy. And so in the middle of that, there's a little discussion of Paul being the chief of sinners and being saved and all that, and purpose of the law and all that. But still, the wrapper of the chapter is the initial charge. What about 2, 1 through 15?
And then women.
Yes. The next few are pairs for the most part. He talks about men lifting up holy hands, suggesting perhaps a worship in which men with a clean conscience can lead in prayers, and women are forbidden from teaching men in that role. And also, I believe there's an implication when he talks about the creation and also the childbearing and all that, that there's just a description of the temperament of women more generally is one of submission. In chapter 3, 1 through 16.
Elders and deacons.
Good, yes, right. In that order, qualifications given. Chapter 4, 1 through 5.
False teachers.
Thank you. And actually describes their doctrine as well. The coming false teachers. 4, 6 through 16. Almost as a contrast to these false teachers and what they teach, what he turns his attention really to Timothy in a way to say, here's what you need to do. So what's the title for that best one?
Exhortation for personal
godliness. And really, in a way, it seemed to me the contrast to these false teachers and maybe the answer as well. 5, 1 through 25.
Widows, elders, and others.
That's right. The others would be the younger and older women, younger and older men, and Timothy's relationship to them. And again, there's widows indeed that would need support, and those that are younger and ought to marry, bear children, that kind of thing. All right, then that leaves, last of all, the poor and rich. There's more in chapter 6. That's a shortcut. It seems to begin by talking, well, first two verses really have to do with masters and slaves and probably belongs up in chapter 5 with regard to the others, right? But 6, 1 through 21, poor and rich. Poor, not necessarily just saying poor people, although the slaves might be in that category, but really those who maybe are preaching or assuming that godliness is the way of gain. Well, it turns out godliness with contentment is great gain, but not the way they were thinking about it as a motive, financial motive. And then he talks about the dangers, and I think maybe aimed at those who are not rich already, but they wish they were. And that desire to be rich is a great temptation and a cause for a lot of different kinds of evil. And then there's some greetings, and he kind of ends by saying, oh yeah, and charge the rich in this world that they not be proud or high-minded and be ready to distribute and all that. So kind of ends with that. So poor and rich is probably not the best title, but it's short and it's easy to remember. Okay, a little more detailed outline here. And I've pretty much talked about this, the charge, the danger of the false teachers, and he talks about the fables and things that they follow. Paul's personal conversion experience with the praise to God for that is a little bit of a parenthesis there in discussion of the purpose of the law. And then conduct in the church, prayers be made for all that are in authority and that we live quiet and peaceful lives, men and women, their relationship, elders and deacons. And then there's kind of a summary and a breaking out into a praise of God there in the end of chapter 3. Then 4:1 begins. It seems I always get these chapters confused just because they're similar, and that is the perilous times in 2 Timothy 3 kind of begins the same way with the same kind of frightening, description of the errors to come. But in this case, he talks about forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats and things like that. They're some very specific kinds of errors. And then he talks about the qualities of a good minister. We call that godliness before, but he talks about these things that Timothy needs to show in his own personal character. And then in chapter 5 through 6, 2, again, the various members, warnings against wrong motives in chapter 6, 3 through 10. And I talked about that before. There really are two kind of bad motives there. One is it seems like some people just like to argue, right? Or they like to be right. So how can you be right if you don't start an argument and show how you can be right, you know? But it almost suggests that they have a mental obsession or an addiction to argument and controversy. And then, of course, thinking that godliness is a way of gain. And he finally concludes with some discussions of Timothy's personal virtue, but then ends with a command for the rich at the end of that. Any comments on 1 Timothy? You kind of see the sense of that. You see how it is a mix, almost on again, of things that the church would need to hear, either from Paul directly through the letter or through Timothy's sermons, and then what Timothy needs to hear personally to live up to the expectations Paul has set for him to fulfill his charge. So you almost see these dual purposes side by side all the way through, one for Timothy and one for the church. Here are some themes that show up in 1 and 2 Timothy. I'm combining them here together, but one is this idea that Timothy has a duty. I charge you, fulfill your ministry. That's all the way through. And there's almost the military sense of Paul saying, you've been enrolled in the army of the Lord, right? As a good soldier, endure hardship. Do your work. You've been given a commission to fulfill that. And so throughout, that's a message. Another one is how important it is to stick to the word. And there's so many different words used, truth and sound doctrine and the holy scriptures or the sacred writing, some versions say. The word, and so on. So all the way through, there's this emphasis on this, I believe, by this time, a body of doctrine and teaching that Timothy would have to hold to in the face of Jewish fables and oppositions of knowledge, falsely so-called, and a bunch of things, you know, that appear to be challenging the church there. And then the other theme I think I see throughout, which I think it's good for us to keep in mind because we often have an idealistic view about the church. There'll never be any problems. We'll never be disappointed in any men. There'll never be stressful situations that result in brethren not getting along with each other. There'll never be people with the wrong motives or hidden agendas. Paul really threw out. I mean, he names people, right, who did him harm, who shipwrecked the faith of different people. And the implication is these are not outsiders that are just coming in. These are people from within the church. And obviously a direct fulfillment then of what he had said to the Ephesian elders back in Acts chapter 20. Throughout, there's that discussion. So we can be very disappointed, but we shouldn't be surprised if that happens in our lives, in our churches, I guess. And finally, theme four, which is really more 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy, and that is here's some things that you need to operate and to know how to operate in the church. Conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church. Okay. And here, this is just another version of the same thing. I was just showing the sample passages, but there's just, you know, a lot of passages that support these themes. Okay. Titus. Author is Paul again, not hard to figure out, says it in the first verse. The reader is Titus. He calls him a son in our common faith in chapter 1, verse 4. He was a co-worker. A lot said about him in 2 Corinthians. Very complimentary things said about him in 2 Corinthians. And he's mentioned in Galatians as kind of the test case for circumcision because it's clear he was a Greek or a Gentile, probably from Antioch of Syria. Maybe that's perhaps where he was converted at the time, maybe during the time Paul was there, maybe earlier. But the purpose and theme of the letter is to encourage Titus in his task to, again, teach sound doctrine in an ungodly culture. Paul emphasizes a lot in Titus the fact that they're idle and lazy gluttons and can't tell the truth except when they say they're idle, lazy gluttons, they're telling the truth. And so there's, you know, there's this poor world that has existed in Crete. Some people think maybe that because Crete was an island, do I have a map of that? No, yeah, I do have it coming up. Let's see if I can get to it. So Crete's down here. In some ways, being an island, especially in those days, made you somewhat protected from any kind of domination by the Roman Empire, who, you know, was kind of in charge of the world at that time. And maybe that isolation, maybe the nice Mediterranean culture and weather, you know, maybe that made them somewhat decadent in their living. And certainly it had its influence in the church. And it almost appears that, I mean, make this story up, but at some point, Paul, in this, between the period that he was in prison, he's free in the middle, and he goes to Crete with Titus, and he just thinks, what is going on here in these churches? And he left Titus there to set things in order, and there's almost an implication that I'm sending some more people, you know, and at least stay there till they get there, almost like he needed to hold the fort against the kind of the chaos and worldliness and so on. And the emphasis all the way through, well, I'll go back now and kind of cover the other things. We'll get to the other things later. But I don't know. I made that story up, but it almost appears that there was a things were not good. Paul got there and said, we got to do something, and I can't stay. Titus, you got to take over here and see what you can do. And there were more than one church. It was the churches there. So the themes were teach in an ungodly culture, which he emphasizes, set the churches in order, appoint elders in every church, rebuke the false teaching. In fact, rebuke factious people generally, chapter 3. And encourage good works. That phrase is in there five times, including a time when it says they're not even capable of good works. So the implication is there needs to be a better adherence to the standards of what a Christian should live. And perhaps it was to hold the fort until Artemis or Tychicus get there. And that you can read about that in chapter 3, verse 12. They're on their way, I suppose. But anyway, do the best you can. So who is Titus? Again, a Greek. Uncircumcised, Galatians 2 tells us, as kind of a test case or exhibit A in that controversy about circumcision. It looks like he was a companion of Paul's from very early in the work. I've talked about that already. It looks like he also may have been the letter carrier and gift bearer, letter carrier to the Corinthians and the gift bearer for the Corinthians. If you look carefully at what Paul says in all these verses in 2 Corinthians. So that seemed like a tough job to me. Going back to Corinth, taking that second letter, which was pretty strong. Not that the first one was a piece of cake or anything, but anyway, he did that, and he's supposed to help them get their gift together. And you know what the 2 Corinthians letter is kind of about is you're not finishing your work, as Russ reminded us yesterday. So Titus given that job, apparently a man of high integrity. He was entrusted with the gifts. That's why I say he was perhaps the gift bearer. And it looks like he had a deep emotional connection with Paul. Paul was hoping to meet him, but he didn't. Here he makes this reference. I had no rest because I did not find Titus, my brother. And yet when he finally came, he was comforted by him. And perhaps he was more courageous than some others. Not Timothy, maybe, to think about, but our boasting to Titus was true. His affections are greater for you, as he remembers the obedience of you all, how with fear and trembling you received him. He not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord. You see a kind of a proactivity in Titus's character there. So anyway, that's I've already talked about Crete there. We know the Cretan society was not, it was just tough. Birthplace of Zeus in the Roman legends. It was known for its dishonesty, greed, immorality, and insubordination, even as their own writers said, they're liars and lazy. It's interesting that in the book, there's an emphasis on sound doctrine and good works five times, which may be kind of the opposite of the fact that they're liars and lazy gluttons, you know, that Paul emphasizes. It's interesting that it's in this letter that Paul says that the elders' children are not accused of riot or insubordination. That's a phrase not found in the First Timothy list, but it's interesting that that's here, not the other. I don't know what all to make of that. So he talks about those whose mind and consciences are defiled. They deny God by their works. They're disqualified for good works, chapter 1, verse 14. And it does appear that it was in the church that need to be rebuked. They're idle talkers, deceivers for dishonest gain. And that's why Titus was left there. All right, let's do the titles. Titus 1, 1 through 4. That's too easy. It's introduction. Whatever introduction means, right? You remember from the letters we looked at last time, they all have a standard form. Paul, I should turn to it. Paul, an apostle. I think he says he's an apostle here. Of Jesus Christ. A servant of God, he said, and an apostle, according to the faith of God's elect, right? To Titus, my true son, our common faith, etc. So that's the introduction. 1, 5 through 16, what's that? Kind of the first thing he jumps into.
Qualifications and work of elders.
That's right. And I don't know that the discussion about there are many insubordinate whose mouths must be stopped in verses 10, 11, I don't know if that's just the job of the elders. I'm sure it isn't. It's what Timothy, I mean, what Titus needs to do as well. But it does seem that that might be the reason for trying to get these men in place, because they needed to, they take, because in each church, not Titus couldn't get there, but in each church they needed to take control and make sure that the, you know, these mouths are stopped and all that. So, and he mentions, I'll just say this for later, verse 14, Jewish fables, commandments of men, just a hodgepodge of errors that need to be addressed. All right, 2, 1 through 15. What'd you put for that?
Christian relations.
Yeah. I mean, so I tried to pick shorter titles for this time, but he talks about the various older women again, young women that and, you know, the implication might be that, I'm sorry to say this, but that the older women were not reverent. That they were actually given too much wine. You understand what I mean? That why would he say that? Is unless that was a danger and a difficulty. They were gossips and all of that. But and the younger women maybe were not faithful to their husbands or not diligent in the home and teaching their children. Is that a possibility? So that he says they need to learn to do that, and maybe the older women should teach them to do that. So the implication, especially in this culture, especially would be that this was teaching that was sorely needed because of the influence. Chapter 3, 1 through 11. What did you put for that?
Behavior.
Yes. And he mentions all kinds of things, being in subject to the rulers and all of that. So these are just how we're supposed to live because we are new people. We've been born again, regenerated by the washing of water. And so we'll talk about that. And then 3, 12 through 15, too easy. It's actually on the same line, personal instructions and greetings. So, yeah, okay. And I think we've covered this pretty much, just a little bit more detail. Interesting here that if the character of these Christians in their relationships, and he says why, and there's almost like a summary of theology here, in 2:11. I'm going to show you this in just a minute. And then here's the attitude we should have toward rulers and authority and all men. And why is because, again, it's another statement of just a summary, a really nice, concise summary of the story of the gospel and our hope of heaven. I mean, a lot of things like that and how we should live as different people. And so it's almost as if this is something that is already there. It's the basis for the arguments. But Paul very briefly, succinctly summarizes it there again for Titus and again for maybe all who would read it. Now, I'll mention to you that at the very last verse of the letter, Titus 3:15, he says, grace be with you all. And then that's Southern for more than one, right? Y'all. And again, the idea that the letter would be read not just by Titus, but would be read to those churches all throughout Crete, as an authoritative message from an apostle, an inspired apostle, and also as a way of giving a kind of a credibility to Titus. Okay, let's go to 2 Timothy now. We're going to fast forward maybe a couple of years. For whatever reason, Paul was rearrested, I guess. And I guess you all know that in those days, you really weren't put in prison to serve your time as we have it today. You were just put in prison to await judgment. Now, it could be 2 years, as we found in Caesarea, because the rulers weren't really interested in swiftly coming to a verdict, especially if they might get a bribe. But Paul was in prison because he was basically either going to die or be acquitted, one or the other. And he was away. So it probably wasn't a long time. Again, Timothy's the reader, probably between 65 and 67. I think it feels like it just wasn't too long. Paul anticipated that there would be a winter because he asked for some clothing to keep warm. But beyond that, I don't think he expected to live much longer. So it may have been a few months there. The purposes and theme are really a last letter from a father, spiritual father, and instructions to Timothy as he, you know, leaves. And he wants to see Timothy before he dies, but I don't know for sure if that ever happened. But the exhortation, again, is to, you know, be a good soldier, suffer hardship. And that's the way it's going to be. Fulfill your ministry. as we talked about before. Okay, let's do the titles here. 1 Timothy 1, 1 through 18. Were you able to figure out, guess my titles for that?
I guess, do not be afraid.
Yes. It's there where he says, God didn't give us a spirit of fearfulness. But he also says in verse 8, don't be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me, his prisoner. Timothy, this is an honorable thing. The world doesn't think so. I know your father in the faith is in jail and going to be executed, but you don't need to be ashamed about that or even afraid. I hope I can come back to that. And then he almost by way of contrast, in verse 16, he says, the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. So almost by example, you know, don't do that. So maybe that's not the key message there, but it just seems to me he's reminding, look, where did your faith come from? Your mom and your grandma, don't let them down. Don't let me down, your father. Don't be ashamed of the word and your work here. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it seemed like that's the message. Sorry, chapter 2. If you guessed images of service, that's correct. There's several there, right at the first, soldiers and farmers and athletes. And he goes on to talk about vessels and a servant in the house and maybe even a road builder or a stone carver or something like that who's handling the cutting straight the word or something like that. So those are images of service. But in that same text, he mentions some false teachers and what they believed, which is the resurrection already come, and they've strayed concerning the faith and overthrown the faith of some in verse 18, Hymenaeus and Philetus in particular. So images of service. And I like at the end of the chapter where he begins to talk about the fact that, yes, they're in error. But, you know, we need to think about people that we're trying to teach that are in error, maybe not necessarily Hymenaeus and Philetus, but those who have been influenced as being under the sway. Their mind isn't working right. They've been taken captive by the devil, and we're not trying to fight them. We're trying to fight the devil and bring them back out of captivity. Anyway, that's chapter 2. Chapter 3, perilous times at the very beginning, and he talks about really scary results, not only in doctrine, but also in action, in chaos and immorality. And then again, by way of contrast, chapter 3, he tells Timothy to abide in the things that you've learned, continue in the faith is another version of that. And in the scripture, which is inspired and makes you profitable for all things and so on. And then the last one is the final charge, chapter 4, very powerful, very succinct, moving. You know, but I don't think Paul would have said it softly if he had had a chance to say it. I think he would have said it loudly and firmly and strongly about not only Timothy's ministry, but the opposition that he would likely face. And then he concludes by talking about his own situation. And despite the fact that he will die, he says, the Lord will deliver me from every evil work, verse 18. And we know how that would happen. So with that, we kind of say goodbye to Paul and his writings and his influence on the early church. I'm going to skip all this. I was going to these are those short passages from 2 Timothy and Titus, which if you just read these, they almost contain every element of the gospel. The fact that we're saved, not according to our works, according to a purpose that existed before time began, but it's now revealed by Jesus, who resurrected, he abolished death, he brought life and immortality to light. You see, it's almost the whole story in a couple of verses. He doesn't need to tell that whole story in great detail about redemption and salvation by faith, as he did in Romans. And then in Titus, the grace of God brings salvation to whom? Well, to all men, even Gentiles, teaching us that in denying ungodliness and worldly lust, see, we have to live a certain way in this present age, but we're looking for the appearing of our Lord and Savior, who substitutionarily died for us, that he might redeem us and purify himself for his own people, zealous for good works. Again, a theme in Titus, but it's tied to the story of Jesus, of the redemption that came through him. And then really right away in the next chapter, the other why for living right. The kindness and love of God appeared toward men, not by works of righteousness, which we've done according to the mercy, the washing of generation. We've got baptism there, renewing of the Holy Spirit, a new mindset that's been poured out. And we have we're heirs according to the hope of eternal life. You see, almost everything that's the heart of what we believe is there. Do you see that? And one suggestion would be, okay, we got it. We got it. We understand it all. We can even write it in two or three verses, right? Now I'm ready for something else. I'd like to enhance that a little. What do we learn next? What are we going to add to this, right? And so by this time, and I'm going to ask for participation here, can you think of some false teachings that have arisen? Not related to this, but just what already do we know has begun to be taught within the church that Paul had either to address or they had to have a meeting about or that he implies by some of the answers he gives? Just help me with some lists of some of the false teachings that were already present at this time.
The resurrection has already taken place.
Good. Thank you. That's mentioned here in 2 Timothy. What else?
You must be a Jew before you're Christian.
Law keeping was required to be justified. You got to be circumcised and keep the law. And that appeared early in Acts, right? Acts 15. And then the Galatian letter seems to be related to that. And maybe another reference to that in Romans as well. And maybe even in Colossians.
Hey, what do you think about being in them going to heaven? There were some issues about what type of body they would have.
Okay. Similar to maybe the resurrection is already passed, maybe the same, I don't know. But 1 Corinthians 15 says there's some who are kind of teaching there's no bodily resurrection. Maybe they were teaching that the resurrection occurred spiritually, and when you died, you just died, and you're dead all over. Or maybe they were saying that the resurrection is not of a physical body. I mean, after all, we've seen the movie about the zombies. We don't want to be raised like that, right? So, and so Paul maybe is addressing that issue that the resurrection, maybe it's already occurred, or maybe it's not really a physical resurrection of dead people. Can't be that. So Paul had addressed that. And some of you, how say some of you, he says in 1 Corinthians 15. Yes, so two things related to what else?
Baptism for the dead.
I don't know that that was a false teaching. He uses that as a proof that there must be a resurrection, I guess.
Oh, okay.
So whatever that means.
Not marrying.
Okay. There and other things, right? Not eating meats. We saw that. That's mentioned in 1 Timothy 4. I get them mixed up. But, yeah, a certain kind of asceticism, maybe. Colossians calls it a severity to the body, which looks good, but, boy, it doesn't really have any value against the indulgences of the flesh. What else? Brigham.
Oh, well, Gnosticism in its various forms, like Jesus doesn't come in the flesh and everything.
Yeah, Colossians mentions that there were maybe some, like, visions that they had or had not seen, depending on how you read the text. And this idea of special knowledge, that may be what Paul is referring to in 1 Timothy 6 when he talks about the oppositions, vain babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge, right? Some special revelation. And you know what? All this easy stuff here, and I'm being facetious, what's beyond that? How can I get more knowledge and be better than others? Well, I can have a special revelation, or I can study science and philosophy and synthesize that with what I know as a Christian. There's evidence of that in Colossians as well. Okay. Anybody else want to make some more?
You got the divisions between Peter and Paul and Christ where it's like you have to join a specific sect and claim that teaching.
Okay, maybe some splintering. I don't know what whatever the teaching might have been. I don't think it was different teaching. It was just I have my favorite philosopher, sophist, that comes and speaks and so on. Well, I've listed a few. You guys have got them all. Keeping the law of Moses, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Maybe you just doesn't matter what you do because now we're forgiven of everything. No resurrection of the dead, or the resurrection's already passed, or mixing with other religious traditions, including Judaism, but maybe others as well, right? Implied in Colossians 2. the incorporation of Jewish fables. How can I be more of a Bible expert than other people? I know the secret meanings of the genealogies and the numbers and the book of Genesis. Not that that would ever happen, right? That people would do those kind of, you know, symbolic things. And that seems like a big problem both in Crete and at Ephesus. There's mysticism of various forms, a special knowledge, as Brigham mentioned, visions, angel worship, and then some special knowledge. Not full-blown Gnosticism, perhaps. We don't know for sure, but it seems like that really didn't come along till several decades later, but still the beginnings of it. And there's always this temptation to know more than the ordinary people. A knowledge aristocracy is sometimes what it's called, right? People who are more privileged because they figured things out that other people don't understand and that kind of thing. And then, of course, as Paula mentioned, asceticism in various forms, abstinence from marriage or from meat, severity to the body is what Paul calls it in the letter to Colossians. Is there a little bit of false teaching already present? And we're not even 30 years since the day of Pentecost. And Paul is dead. I'm sorry, I'm yelling. I'm just trying to be dramatic. What are we going to do?
Go back to the beginning.
Well, we have this revelation, don't we? I wonder if, who is going to take Paul's place in reminding everybody? Now, we said the teaching is pretty much in place, and what needs to be done is remind the brethren and stick to the sound or healthy doctrine, right? Preach the word, because there'll be people that don't want to hear it or have different motives for teaching the wrong thing. Whose mouths must be stopped, Paul said. Who's going to do that? Who is going to do that? I want you to, so I was thinking about the fact that, and you probably should know two of these right away. I was thinking about different men who traveled with Paul, and the criteria would be they traveled with him, or they traveled to him to bring him something, so they had a close association with him, or maybe he sent them somewhere, but it's clear they had, not like they had a church in their house, not just that, I mean more than that. I mean they traveled with Paul as companions, co-workers, were sent to some place to help the church there. Can you think of at least two men that would maybe be younger that would take up the mantle after this lesson? Who would they be? Yeah, Luke. Timothy and Titus. Interesting, in Hebrews 13:23, the Hebrew writer, whoever it is, I don't think Paul necessarily, says that Timothy's in prison. I wonder if he expected that, right? And I suspect that he kind of knew that he was following his father in the faith, but that he was in prison. Can you think of anybody else besides Timothy and Titus? There's a lot of blank space on this chart.
Mark,
good. Barnabas' cousin, younger man. Now, he kind of messed up, or we think he abandoned Paul in the first journey. Did he ever recover in Paul's estimation?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. In fact, this very second letter, he's praised or requested by Paul. Good. Mark, who else?
Luke.
Luke traveled with Paul, didn't he? Quite a bit. And he actually made himself a kind of a scholar with regard to Jesus' life, didn't he? He wrote an orderly account. And then he was kind of an expert on the history of the early church. First the work of Peter in Acts, and then the work of Paul and others. So Luke would certainly be on. What are some others?
Epaphroditus.
Sorry. I'm getting too many at once. I didn't hear either one.
Epaphroditus.
Thank you. Good. We have him in relationship, what is it, the church at Philippi? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going there, teaching, taking gifts, bringing stuff to Paul.
Getting sick.
Tychicus. We remember him. That's how we know Ephesians and Colossians went about the same time, because he carried those letters and probably carried news about Paul and was a companion of Paul in the first imprisonment.
Onesimus.
Good. Onesimus. Right. I don't know if Onesimus turned out to go become a preacher missionary, but he certainly was with Paul for long enough to have been a companion and learned from Paul, traveled, carried a letter.
There's a whole list in Acts 20 of those that traveled with him to Jerusalem.
That's right. And these were men trusted by the churches. And do you think that having taken a trip with Paul would have been a benefit? The fact is they were mobile and willing to dedicate some part of their life to the work of the church. Okay, that's enough. We're running out of time. But I forgot to reorder these. Priscilla and Aquila come to mind. Did they ever travel on behalf of the gospel and do work? Luke, you mentioned Silas. He's still around. In fact, mentioned by Peter. And he's called Silvanus at that point. But you think Silas could continue the work? And Mark, we've mentioned Apollos. Remember him coming and going at the request of the churches and of Paul. Don't know how old he was. He may not have been a next generation, but we certainly find him mentioned. And he's even mentioned in Titus as maybe coming to Crete to help them. Now, these are way out of order, but it's okay. You get the idea. Here are some men. All of these traveled with Paul or went to a place or said they were going to come to a church. Erastus, Trophimus, Aristarchus, Jesus called Justus is with Paul when he writes Colossians. Epaphras, not to be confused with Epaphroditus, right? Who's mentioned both in Colossians and Philemon. Tychicus, somebody mentioned, carried the Ephesian letter. Demas, it didn't turn out great, but in Philemon 24, he's positively mentioned. So there's someone, and they don't all do the best, but he, of course, left Paul loving the present world. Gaius is mentioned as a traveler. Sopater of Perea, Zenas the lawyer, is going to come to Crete and help out, maybe give Titus a break in Titus 3:13. Crescens is coming, 2 Timothy 4, verse 9. Or is sent, I think it says what he says there. I'm not talking about these are just Christians. You know, there's a lot of Christians mentioned, especially in Romans at the end. These are men who went somewhere in the service of Paul or a church or because he told them to go there. You understand what I'm saying there? You guys are laughing. Is it because I'm screaming? What? Secundus of Thessalonica. These are the ones that Sewell mentioned in Acts 20. Sopater, Secundus, Gaius. And then there's this group of men. I don't know what the story there is, but there's three of them that are apparently ministering to Paul in some way. Stephanus, Fortunatus, Achaicus, and then finally Archippus, who maybe was Philemon's son, but he might have been a minister there in the church, either there or at Laodicea, so we don't know. I'm sure this isn't a complete list, but this is what I could put together this afternoon. Are you impressed with this? We talked about the fact that when Paul was in his first imprisonment, what all had he accomplished? Well, he established a church in the Gentiles. He defeated the false doctrine about the circumcision being required. He had established the epistle. What was that word that was in there? Epistolary, I think it was called. He established a bunch of authoritative writings and so on. But it seemed to me this is another thing Paul did. And that is he had these men in relationship with him. And as he rushed around, maybe even went to Spain during that period of time, some little evidence that he got to Spain even. But during that time, he was training men and sending men and writing letters to these men so that they would be ready. Sewell, help me here.
You may be about to say that, but then you told Timothy to do the same thing he had in training other men.
I was not. 2 Timothy 2:2, who will teach others also. So the chain continues even beyond that. So that's the story. So we can say goodbye to the Apostle Paul. The Lord delivered him out of every evil work. I'm not concerned about that part of it. But here's the legacy that's beyond the written letters that he wrote of men who had been trained, who clearly loved him, understood his as he said, Ephesians 3, could perceive his understanding into the mystery and could carry it forward and ensure that sound doctrine was preserved. That's all I have tonight.
Maybe they could call these the parental epistles instead of the pastoral, since he calls all of them his sons.
That fits. That's really good. As of today, I'm going to call them that. Just because it's just smart aleck enough for me, I guess, and it deserves an explanation, and that explanation is real informative, right?
Thank you, Marty.
Thanks a lot. Okay.